science of kind of spiritual reality and humanity against God. And that's where sin enters creation straight away in Genesis chapter 3. And God's response to that is something that's going to shape our reading of the Old Testament throughout tonight. There's this sort of perfect, glorious, balanced tension between promise on the one hand. There will be the seed from the woman and you will bite his heel and he will crush your head. There's promise on the one hand, there's the grace, and there is also curse and exile. And those two things kind of interweave throughout the entirety of human history and God's dealing with human history. And this is the great question that is sort of hanging over us at the start of the Old Testament, as we come out of Genesis 3, really, is what is God going to do? While he is waiting for the promise to be fulfilled, while he's waiting for Satan's head to be crushed at the cross, how is he going to relate to this fallen world? How is he going to relate to a cursed reality, creation? How does a holy God relate to a sinful world? And you might think that the obvious answer to that is he would destroy it. You know, that would be, in one sense, a very natural response of a holy God to a world that he has created that has rebelled against him. If he were to destroy that completely, just take it out of existence again, that would be an entirely appropriate, perhaps logical, intuitive response. But actually, that's not what he does. And we're just going to watch that tension play out throughout the history of the world. Now, as soon as there is sin in the world, there are two humanities. Okay, so there are those who respond to grace and who call on the name of the Lord, and there are those who don't. And straight away you see that conflict, you see that hostility, you see that persecution being played out. Jesus tells us in Matthew chapter 10 that he would divide families. And you see that crystallized again and again. Straight away, as soon as sin is in the world, there is division. There is conflict. There is persecution. We see it with Cain and Abel. We see it with Jacob and Esau. And I think what's really frightening is how quickly sin totally embeds itself in creation. You know, there's no kind of gradual sort of contamination process. It's sudden. It's straight away. Sin is completely embedded in the life of creation. So by the end of Genesis chapter 4, we've covered all of this ground. We've got polygamy is suddenly on the scene. By Genesis chapter 4, verse 19, Lamech marries two women. We've got violence and murder going on. Chapter 4, verse 8, Cain obviously attacks his brother Abel and kills him. And then verse 23, this geezer Lamech again, I've killed a man for wounding me. And of course, there's injustice in that as well, isn't there? He goes on to say, if Cain is avenged seven times, Lamech will be avenged 77 times, which I think lies behind. You know, when Peter comes and says, how often do I forgive my brother? And Jesus is like, yeah, 70. It's not seven times, buddy. A lot more than that. I think this is where Jesus is camping out in that. All right, so by the end of Genesis chapter 4, you can see just how quickly God's vision for his creation, the creation that he declared to be good, indeed very good, is unraveling. And in Genesis chapter 5, you know, so we're only two chapters in. Genesis chapter 5, the most commonly recurring words are, and then he died. It's just a long list of people who die. And you're like, what? This is depressing. Why are you telling me this? And it's showing us that with immediate effect, as soon as there is sin in the world, on the day you eat of it, you will die. And immediately, death becomes our common experience. And then by Genesis chapter 6, verse 5, the Lord saw how great the wickedness of the human race had become on the earth. That, and feel the power of this, that every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time. Right? I mean, just let each of those sentences, kind of phrases, just kind of settle in on you, and just think that's within three chapters of the Bible's account of human history. Everything is unraveling. And the question really then becomes, what is God's response to this new world going to be? How is a holy God going to deal with a creation that has rebelled against him? And you know Genesis chapter 6, that's the part of the introduction to the story of Noah and the flood. And God's response is precisely a declaration of judgment and destruction. That is God, a holy God's response to sin and evil and the havoc that it creates is to destroy it. But that declaration, that destruction is preceded by a period of amnesty, what we call grace, during which the gospel is preached and people have an opportunity to escape the judgment that is to come. Right? And I think the reason this is all spelled out at Genesis chapter 6 is because this is the paradigm. This is the way God is going to deal with a fallen creation. He declares that there will be judgment. There will be destruction. He will not allow a sinful creation to continue in existence in perpetuity. Got there. All right? But before that destruction comes, he will give people a chance to relish his grace and to be reconciled to him. All right, and so this is the big question, isn't it? As the Apostle Peter looks back on this, here, this is the thing. It's like, is God going to be just in his judgment? Is God going to be fair in his dealings with this world? And Peter's point is, he did not spare the ancient world when he brought the flood on its ungodly people, but he protected Noah, the preacher of righteousness. So straight away, there's this clear sense that what we're going to see over and over again is that God the destruction will come, but God is able to save those who trust in him. And that's the dynamic that we need to get our hold on. It's why Methuselah is the oldest guy in the Bible, right? You know, Methuselah means when he dies, it will come. That's what Methuselah means. So there's this prophecy that the flood is going to come, and Methuselah is given the name, when he dies, it will come. All right? Why is Methuselah the oldest man in the Bible? That is a testimony to God's grace. He will hold destruction off as long as he possibly can to give people as much of a chance as possible to respond to those who are preaching righteousness. They have over 1,000 years of warning and of the gospel being proclaimed and of grace being offered before the flood comes. And that's the world we live in, and that's how God is going to deal with this world. Now, back to the story of Noah. I think it's one of the weirdest things about the Old Testament is we've taken the story of Noah, which is the story of God's judgment and wiping out all but eight of the entirety of the human race, utterly destroying creation. We've turned it into a kid's story to help children learn how to count. I'm like, that's just insane. How did that happen? All right, it wasn't like this at all. All right, it was a much more traumatic experience. It's exactly what we said at the start. God decreating the world, winding the story of creation back, as it were, to day two before the land has come up out of the water. The whole, it's not like it rained heavily for 40 days. All right? You read it. It's like, no, God is decreating the world, taking it back to its very foundations. It's like this inbreaking of the judgment that there will be at the end of the world, anticipating the new creation and the renewal of all things. And that's what we get is, as we come out of the flood, you know, you have this guy, Noah, who leads this sort of humanity into this renewed creation. And it's like, yeah, okay, that's what Jesus is going to be like, a second Noah. And, you know, you've got the whole thing with the dove, and here's this man coming up out of the waters, and the dove is there, and he's stepping out into this new creation. And it's all just sort of explaining to us, mapping out for us, the dynamics of grace and what this is going to look like as history unfolds. And, of course, after he's done that, after he's sort of established that paradigm in creation, God hangs up his bow. And there's some scholars who make a huge amount of the fact that the word that is used in Genesis for the rainbow is the same word that's used for a war bow, as in the weapon, as in bows and arrows. And, you know, there's this deep sense of God has declared war on the world, a sinful world. But now he's kind of hanging up his bow. And there is this sort of absence of war. God is withholding. He said, now that he's shown what he's going to do, that period of grace now is going to start over again. And God withholds his prerogative to judge. And there's this sort of sense of absence of war. But the question still lingers. Can there be anything more than that? Can there be friendship? After all, nothing has actually changed. At the end of the account of the flood, we're told, Genesis chapter 8 now, that every inclination of their heart is still evil from childhood. So human nature hasn't changed. But what does change is that God enters into a covenant. All right? And this is one of the big ideas in the Bible. Not just the Old Testament, the whole Bible. This is massive work. Where God, in a covenant, God binds himself. He commits himself to a certain course of action. All right? And it might, in a sense, and I'm going to use this word very carefully, that course of action might not be a natural one for God, but it is the course of action that he is going to hold himself to as he relates to this fallen world. And so the covenant that comes out of the flood is, even though every inclination of their heart is evil from childhood, never again will I destroy all living creatures as I have just done. All right, so and if God didn't say that, can you imagine how precarious our existence would be? How volatile the relationship between a holy, righteous God and a sinful, cursed world would be. Like, every time it rained, there would be utter panic. Because is this the day when God is going to destroy the world again? No. How do we know that? Because we've changed? No. Because God has committed himself to a certain course of action. And that is what allows history then to unfold. Now, here's the deal, is that God is committed to a certain course of action. But what we're going to find is that a fallen humanity is committed to a certain course of action as well, a certain pattern of behavior. And, the next big event in Genesis, I promise, when we get out of Genesis, we'll move much more quickly, all right? Just so that you know, it's like, man, he's been going for nearly 20 minutes and we're not out of Genesis yet. What? Genesis 11. And this is, I've got no idea if this is what the Tower of Babel actually looked like or not. Not a notion. But what's interesting, you come into Genesis chapter 11, verse 2, the people moved eastward. Now that's quite significant, because when they were cast out of Eden, they were cast out eastward. All right, when Cain was cursed by God and was condemned to be a restless wanderer, he went eastward. Okay, here again, fallen humanity is moving eastward. And when the tabernacle is built, and the temple, the door of the tabernacle must face east. So that this fallen humanity that has, in a sense, been moving further and further and further away from God is able to come back in and find an open door in God's grace. So they're moving eastward. And they the plain of Shinar, I'm not going to do this tonight, but just as you're reading through the Bible, all right, just clock the plain of Shinar and see how often that comes up and the sort of things that go on there. All right, it's uncanny. It's one of those things, once you clock it, it's everywhere. Oh my, so much stuff goes on the plain of Shinar. Anyway, so the people, this fallen people of God, they're moving away from God, and they have this brilliant idea. Come, they say, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens. So that should be that. So that we may make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we will be scattered over all the earth. Now, there's so much that's going on here. How much do we do? Right. No. Okay. So, like, we got one. This idea of we are united in our experience of fallenness, but we are going to build ourselves a way to heaven. Okay. We're going to stay together. Okay, just a little bit. All right. So, Cain, you know, what was Cain's curse? To be what? A restless wanderer. And here's humanity saying, we are not going to be restless wanderers. We are going to stay together and we are going to settle down. Okay? What was God's commission? To go and fill the earth. Right, we're not going to do that. We do not want to be scattered over the whole earth. We want to stay together. So everything in this is kicking against God and saying, you will not define us. You will not tell us who we are going to be. All right? And this whole thing is that we can do this ourselves. All right? They were supposed to increase in number and fill the earth, but Genesis 11:2, they settled. All right? And they've got this whole thing. They want to make a great name for themselves. And it's really interesting when God then steps in to deal with Abraham in Genesis chapter 12, right? One of the things that he says to Abraham is, I will make your name great. All right, so everything that humanity is trying to do to defy the curse, to get themselves to heaven, actually God is going to do for us through his covenant with Abraham. You know, that's where we find our true unity. In Christ. That's how we get to heaven, through Christ. All right? That's where we find rest. That's where we find the city that we're supposed to inherit, in Christ. And this is how our name is made great, in Christ. Okay? But all of this is going on. And, you know, Babel just means confused. And of course, later, Babel becomes the city of Babylon. And it's like, this is the city of fallen humanity. And over and against that, of course, you've got Zion, which is the city of God. And, you know, we've been through the book of Revelation, so you know how those two things chart themselves out. And right at the very end of the age, the whole of the human race is sort of characterized as dwelling in one of these two cities. You're either in Zion, or you are in Babylon. And that dividing line is still running through humanity all the way through history. Right? And so there's this covenant made with this guy, Abraham, who's called out of Ur of the Chaldees. And the Chaldeans, again, they're the people who later in the Bible you're going to know as the Babylonians. All right? The Chaldeans are the Babylonians. So Abraham... And remember this, so Abraham, it all begins when Abraham is called out of the Chaldees, out of Babylon, and into fellowship with God. And of course, Isaiah 41 verse 8, Abraham is called the friend of God. And so we've gone from this place of open warfare, where God simply destroys creation, to a place, to a situation where God is committing himself now to friendship with sinners who respond to his grace and his covenant. All right? So, the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth. That's the end of the story of of Babel, right? But Abraham, I will make you into a great nation, and all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. So at Babel, what happens at Babel is God invents nations, scatters them over the earth, gives them different languages, different cultures. So in a sense, at Babel, that's where the nations come into being. And then the next thing that happens is that God makes this covenant with Abraham that says, but through you and through this promise and the seed that will come from you, those nations will be blessed. So even in, again, this thing, judgment but grace. Judgment but grace all the time. That's the tension. And you have that extraordinary sort of story, don't you, in Genesis chapter 15. We were looking at this a couple of Sunday evenings ago, where the Lord comes to kind of confirm his covenant, his promise to Abraham. And he says this. He says, this is Genesis chapter 15. Abraham said, "Sovereign Lord, how can I know that I will gain possession of this land, of everything that you're promising me?" So the Lord said to him, "Bring me a heifer, a goat, and a ram, each 3 years old, along with a dove and a young pigeon." So they're all animals that will be used in the sacrificial system in Leviticus later in the Bible. Abraham brought all these to him, cut them in two, and arranged the halves opposite each other. The birds, however, he did not cut in half. And then as the sun is setting, Abraham fell into a deep sleep, and a thick and dreadful darkness came over him. Then the Lord said to him, "Know for certain that for 400 years your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, that they will be enslaved and ill-treated. But I will punish the nation they serve as slaves, and afterwards they will come out with great possessions. You, however, will go to your ancestors in peace and be buried at a good old age. In the fourth generation, your descendants will come back here, for the sin of the Amorites has not yet reached its full measure." And when the sun had set and darkness had fallen, a smoking brazier and a blazing torch appeared and passed between the pieces of the animals. And on that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram. All right, and you know, you have to wait to Jeremiah to work out what that's all about, in a way. But God is saying, look, you know, to violate a covenant that is made by walking between animals that have been cut in half is like saying, you know, if I break this covenant, do to me what has been done to these animals. All right, so this is God walking between these animals and saying, if I break this covenant, all right, if this doesn't work out the way I'm saying it's going to, you know, literally rend me asunder, tear me apart. All right, that's how deeply committed God is to this. Now, I want to just talk a little bit about this idea of covenant, because this keeps coming up. It just keeps coming up. This idea of God committing himself to a course of action. God making a promise that he will act in certain situations, he will act in certain ways. And inviting a kind of a response of faith and obedience to that covenant. And the reason I want to make this a big deal is because, let's see, where do we deal with this? Well, all right, let me just say for now, we'll come back to this, okay? Don't mix up the covenants. That's so much of our confusion, I think, around the Old Testament comes from the fact that we mix our covenants up. And we take things that are said to particular people in a particular situation, and God says, I'm going to commit myself to act to you in this way. And we apply those then to other people. And we can't always do that. And I'll give you an example of that later on. All right, but the rest of Genesis, really, is God promising, God's fulfilling that promise that he's just made to Abraham in Genesis chapter 15. Know for certain that for 400 years your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, that they will be enslaved and ill-treated there. All right, so the rest of Genesis is how does Abraham's descendants get to the place where they are in a country, where they're strangers in a country that's not their own. Right, that's basically the rest of the book of Genesis. Now, there's still this question, though, of can we trust God with judgment? Yeah, can we trust God with judgment? And we saw it a little bit earlier on, but the place where this is really worked out is when Abraham meets Christ, who's on the way to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. Do you remember that story? Christ turns up with two angels, and Abraham feeds them. And then, you know, Christ explains, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. Again, this sort of like this inbreaking of the judgment from the end of the age. And Abraham does this thing where he says, well, what about if you find 50 righteous people? Are you still going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah? And the Lord's like, no, I wouldn't destroy them for 50. And then Abraham kind of, what about 40? What about 30? And he keeps sort of coming down and down and down. And it's like, you know, and we often think, is Abraham bargaining with God for Sodom and Gomorrah? I don't think he's doing that at all. He actually tells us what he's doing. He is wrestling with this question because he knows that there is at least one family in there that is righteous. And that's Lot. And his question is, okay, you're going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. Are you able to save Lot out of that? And he's having to kind of emotionally process the fact that God is going to come in judgment. And he's having to work out, it's okay, I can trust God in judgment because, yes, he will be able to rescue the righteous when that judgment comes. And again, it's this bit from 2 Peter. The Lord knows how to rescue the godly from trials and to hold the unrighteous for punishment on the day of judgment. All right, and it's so, I think it's really interesting to me that is such a big deal in the book of Genesis. You know, it's almost as if as soon as we recognize that a holy God will move in judgment against the world, the Bible knows, it knows that we are going to wrestle with that question. Can we trust God with judgment? Will he be fair? You know, and think about how many questions people have about the day of judgment and how that's going to work out for people. And it's like right at the beginning of the Bible, there's this book where again and again and again, that question is addressed. Does God know? Will God be able to judge with justice? Will the God of all the earth do what is right? Can he save his people? Can he save those who trust in him, even in the midst of judgment? And the answer again and again in the book of Genesis is, yes, he can. And yes, he will. And the book of Genesis closes looking ahead to the day of judgment and the day of grace that all this has been pointing us towards. Genesis 49, an extraordinary chapter where it's like the whole history of the Old Testament is laid out for you in one chapter. It's like a prequel. And it's when Jacob is blessing his sons. He's blessing the patriarchs and the tribes that are going to come from them. And in the midst of it all, he prophesies over Judah. And he says, the scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he to whom it belongs shall come. And the obedience of the nations shall be his. All right, and that's kind of where Genesis finishes with this. Yeah, don't worry, it's all coming good. Now we stop into the book of Exodus. We're so familiar with the book of Exodus. I'm not going to spend any time on it at all, actually, this evening, except to say that, you know, again, if you're in our Sunday evening services, you'll have heard me say this before, but the book of Exodus is just this huge acting out. It's like this dress rehearsal of salvation. You know, you've got the people of God who are enslaved. They're living under death. You've got this Pharaoh, this tyrannical figure who's overruling them, who's enslaved them, who's killing their children. And into that Christ comes, the Passover lamb, to redeem his people and to deliver them and to bring them to Sinai, where they will meet with God the Father. All right, and so in a few minutes we'll pick up at Sinai. But I thought what we'd do is we'd just take a break for about 10 minutes. And hopefully as you came in, you were given a bunch of this week's prayer notes. We've been given these leaflets out every day. What would be really good is just for 10 minutes, if we just review everything we've prayed through this week and pray for it again this evening. So what I'm going to suggest is that now, in the next 10 minutes or so, if you're just in groups of three or four, you pick out a couple of things from Monday and Tuesday. All right, just Monday and Tuesday. Don't go into Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. We'll do that later in the evening. But it'd be good just to pick out a couple of things from Monday and Tuesday and spend a bit of time praying for those. So we'll just spend 10 minutes on that now, if that's okay. And then we'll come back and we'll pick up at Mount Sinai.